Chapter 20. Another decorative vase smashed to the ground and joined its fallen comrade on the floor of one of Ithaca's stately studies. It seemed the culprit of this destruction was Rylan, since he stood precariously on a wobbly stepladder and tried to put something inside a third and final ceramic vase sitting on top of a very tall bookshelf. "Rylan," I called, as the glowstones in the wall sconces intuitively brightened at my presence. "Rylan!" The stable boy continued to reach up on tiptoes as if he didn't even hear me, but his wrapped leg, much better now thanks to Madam Midgen's healing ways, was still weak, and his position caused his bad leg to strain and tremble with fatigue. I recognized that type of jelly feeling from when I took one too many kicks to the leg while sparring, and I knew it was only a matter of seconds before the kid's leg gave out. With my luck, he would end up with a second broken leg after re-breaking the first, and if that happened, I was pretty sure I would have an ass-kicking coming my way from a very batty priestess. "What's he doing?" Horace asked from over my shoulder as he took in the bizarre scene and saw what the problem was. "I don't know," I said as I started to cross the room. "But I need to get to him before—" Shit! Sure enough, the stable boy's janky leg gave up the good fight, and I watched almost in slow motion how his knee buckled before he began to fall off the tall stool. I sprinted the rest of the way toward him and outstretched my arms with the intention of catching him. However, just because Rylan was small for his age didn't mean he was weightless, and since he was a gawky preteen, it was almost like trying to catch a potato sack full of broomsticks. In the end, I more so broke his fall rather than catch him. "Ugh!" I grunted, as I also lost my balance and fell back on my ass with him somewhat draped over my lap. His brown eyes were open and glazed as he stared upward with a blank expression on his face. "Rye?" I cupped the kid's cheek and jostled him gently. "Buddy, are you all right?"
"Don't tell Alex I broke his favorite glass pillows," he murmured.
There was a slight frown on his face, but for the most part, his eyes remained eerily wide and fixed. "Pillows?" I glanced around at the shattered vases and then back at him as I started to put two and two together. "What's wrong with him?" Horace asked, and crouched down by my side so he could take the stable boy's temperature with the back of his hand. "I think he's sleepwalking," I whispered, and snickered under my breath. "Rylan, what are you trying to do with all the, pillows?"
"Alex told me I needed to protect his herald core," he said in a dreamy voice,
and then he opened his curled fist to reveal the ruby-red gem I told him to hold on to earlier.
"I need to hide it so it'll be safe. But when I tried to hide it in the clouds, they turned into pillows and kept floating away. And now they fell out of the sky and Alex will be mad."
"Nah," I said, as I gently took the core from him and stashed it away in my pocket for later. Then I helped the boy to his feet with my arm around his shoulders. "I have it on good authority Alex thinks those pillows are ugly anyway, and won't be upset that they're gone." I rubbed my hand up his arm to try and dispel the chill seeping into his skin, and I shook my head in exasperation when I noticed he'd been wandering around the drafty manor in just his thin sleep shirt and pants.
"Are you sure?"
the boy asked, and a few tears tracked silently down his face. If he was aware he was crying, it wasn't apparent due to his still zombified expression. The tears worried me a little, and what started out as something amusing soured when I realized he was really quite distressed. I entertained thoughts of waking him up so I could get him to see it was me in order to reassure him better, but I read somewhere how it was bad to try and wake up a sleepwalker, or something. The last thing Rylan needed in his condition was more anxiety. "Buddy, even if those were Alex's most favorite pillows in the universe, in his opinion, they don't compare to his awesomely cool foster son," I said, as if I was imparting some great secret.
"Really?"
he asked in his monotone voice.
"You're sure he won't be mad?"
"Positive," I said, and pulled him in even closer. He was starting to feel a little warmer now, but I wished I had a cloak or blanket to put over his shoulders. "And besides," Horace said, as he untied his lightweight cape from his shoulder strap and draped it around Rylan, "if he is mad, you can just blame it on old Uncle Horace."
"Okay,"
Rylan murmured, and just like that, the tense worry stringing his frame so taut relaxed, and he wound his wiry arms around my waist, closed his eyes, and buried his face into my shirt.
"I'll just blame it on Uncle Horace."
I snorted but gave the Falcon Man a grateful grin as I adjusted the cape more securely around the kid's thin shoulders. "Good lad," Horace said fondly, and placed a hand briefly on his shaggy mop. "Thanks for helping me calm him down," I said to the black-feathered man, as I rubbed a little circle into Ryland's back. "I don't know what to do with him sometimes." "I think you're doing just fine, Chief," he said, and cocked his head as he watched Ryland doze off against me. "Did he, is he asleep again?" I looked down and noticed how the stable boy was now drooling a fine wet spot into my tunic. "It appears so. He's so weird." "Yes, he is," Horace said gravely and put a hand over his heart. "And I hate to tell you this, but wootfruit doesn't grow far from the tree it fell from." "Is that your way of calling me weird, too?" I asked, and mocked scowled at him. "He is your son," the Falcon Man shrugged, in an if-the-shoe-fits sort of way. "You do know he's not physically mine, right?" I deadpanned. "That has nothing to do with it," he said, and I pursed my lips in thought. "True. I guess I'll own it. I'm weird." I gave a similar shrug, and then we both broke out into quiet snickering. "But I should really get him to bed, and then I also need to pass the fuck out, because tomorrow is going to be busy. I think we finally have the materials to start building the barn, and I want to get as much done at Ithaca tomorrow before we head to the other estate." "You really need to think of a name for that place," he said, and went over so we could hold the parlor door open. I sighed as I unclamped Ryland's bony arms and then hefted him up, and he immediately let out a snore and nuzzled harder into my chest to where his face was almost completely hidden in my armpit. So weird. "I know I need to name it, but nothing I can think of really fits," I said, as I angled my body through the door so I wouldn't bang Ryland's feet against the jamb. "I'm open to suggestions." "I'll think on it as well," Horace said. And he went with me so I could tuck the kid back in bed, like an errant lamb that needed to be rescued by a shepherd. "Uncle Horace, huh?" I grinned when, instead of taking back his cape, the Falcon Man tucked it more snugly around the stable boy. "What can I say?" He shrugged and rubbed his chin. "He kind of grows on you." "Like a fungus, right?" I snorted. "Accurate." Horace frowned down at my weirdo foster son with a confused expression as if he didn't understand how he could like the strange, hyperactive kid so quickly, and I could definitely relate. "Welcome to the club of people Ryland Dahl has wrapped around his little finger, my friend," I said, and clapped him on the back before I led us out and back into the corridor on the second floor. "You don't understand. I don't even like kids," the perplexed Falcon Man said, as if I just told him the truth about the Tooth Fairy. "I didn't think I did either, brother," I laughed, and I pulled the door closed as silently as I could so Ryland would stay the fuck asleep, honestly. Madam Midgen was going to skin me alive if he didn't freaking heal. This much I knew for certain. I hadn't known the eccentric Batwoman for very long, but I knew she took the care and well-being of her patients very seriously. Speaking of her patients, "You need to go to bed too, man," I said, and kind of shoved Horace toward the bedroom right next to Rye's. "And no more napping in the parlor. You live here now, so this is your room."
"But I..."
Oh, he trailed off with a strange look on his face, as if he didn't realize this salient fact.
"Are you sure? I could just find somewhere to sleep out..."
"If you seriously finish that sentence with the word outside, I will actually punch you," I said with a cocked eyebrow. The Falcon Man grew quiet as his frown deepened, and he cast his gaze to the ground, as if he was struggling with something mentally.
"You mean, I'm not..."
He cut himself off and ran a hand through his black-feathered crest. "Not what?" I prodded.
"A burden,"
he finished, and finally brought his gold-green eyes back up to mine. "No," I said simply.
"Look at this place, Horace. There are way too many rooms, and I'm pretty sure I have enough gold to pay for everyone for 100 seasons, if not more. Plus, you're my wife's brother, and kind of my best friend, so..."
That last point got his attention better than any of the logistical facts I listed previously, and his mouth fell open a little in shock. I just looked at him as if what I said was just another factoid, and nothing particularly special. A pleased smile appeared on his face when he finally got it, and he gave me a nod in acknowledgement before that smile stretched into a wily smirk.
"I guess you're my best friend, too. Even if you are a bit strange in the head, he conceded as he rolled his eyes. Seriously, combining herald cores? It's like you want to die. You still haven't explained what's so bad about combining cores, I pointed out.
Well, other than the fact we could both perish in a horrible explosion,
the Falcon Man asked matter-of-factly.
Huh. Well, if anybody can figure out how not to do that, it's you, I'm sure.
I gave him a smug little smirk and then patted him once before I all but shoved him toward his room. Now, go to bed, H.
See? Crazy,
Horace said, and he gesticulated wildly to the ceiling as he retreated to his room. I just shook my head and made sure the door remained closed to the Falcon Man's room. I even waited in the silent hall for a few extra beats just to make sure neither he nor Rylan would come out again for something as foolish as trying to please me or for being a burden. In the deep quiet, I was able to hear the sound of someone trying to hold their breath in order to not be overheard, and I immediately straightened my spine. Even though I didn't have the voice like Mech did, I still summoned all my intimidation and growled out lowly to the mysterious person.
"Whoever you are, you need to come out and show yourself," I said, and my muscles were coiled tight and ready to spring.
If there really was someone in the manor ready to do my family harm, I would take care of it, then check on those fucking lanterns again.
"Scah!"
came the gleeful cawing of an aggravating chromoth moments before a yellow ball of dusty fluff and feathers thudded into my chest like an auto-launch baseball in a batting cage.
"Oh, Rue, no!"
A whispered giggle sounded just before my bashful phoenix wife revealed herself from around the corner. Her petal-like hands folded over her pretty mouth as she tried to hold in her laughter so she wouldn't wake anyone up. However, it must have been difficult to keep her mirth at bay, seeing as how I spluttered and wheezed due to the wind being knocked out of me by a bowling ball with tail feathers.
"Rufus, I missed you too, yeesh,"
I said as he roughly nudged under my chin and hugged my neck with his four fuzzy moth paws. I wriggled my nose and tried not to sneeze at all the yellow dust he was shedding in his excitement. And in that moment, I couldn't help but laugh as well, because damn it, I really did miss the little cretin.
"I'm sorry for lurking, husband,"
Shay said as she finally came to my rescue and plucked the gold seeker away from where he was actively trying to burrow into my ribcage.
"But I just couldn't help myself from listening."
"How long have you been there?" I asked curiously and came up next to her so I could wrap my arm around her mostly bare shoulders. The nightdress she'd changed into was a soft green gauzy thing that looked as comfy as it did beautiful. But it wasn't very practical in the way of insulation. Added to the fact she was prancing around the corridors barefoot, and it was almost like she wanted to catch pneumonia. Still, her earnestness and overwhelming beauty in the moonlight made me roll my eyes internally at how head over heels I was for her, even though her carelessness was as exasperating as it was endearing.
"Since I heard Rylan accidentally break the vase,"
she admitted with another sheepish grin, as I led us out of the corridor and toward the stairs where our suite was.
"I came to check in on you when you'd been gone for so long, and I was on my way down the stairs when I heard it and grew worried. I wanted to intervene, but I got distracted watching you with him, and then again with my brother just now."
Shay slowed until we were stopped on the middle landing that broke the grand staircase in two before it curved up to the right onto the third floor. "Shay?" I asked, when she looked down and stroked Rufus in her arms, as if drawing comfort from the cuddly creature.
"Sometimes I have to remind myself I'm awake, and for a moment I was worried I was trapped in a dream, and none of this exists outside my mind,"
she whispered, as if telling me a terrible secret. I lifted her face gently with a finger tucked under her delicate chin so I could try and decipher the thoughts swimming through that intelligent brain of hers. "Why would you think this was all a dream, sweetheart?"
"Because I haven't seen that look of peace and acceptance on my brother's face for a long, long time,"
she said, and then her beautiful eyes overflowed with her crystalline tears, even though the smile she gave me was nearly blinding.
"Thank you for being so kind to him."
"Oh, honey," I said, and pulled her in so I could embrace her fully. "You don't have to thank me for doing the right thing. Anyone you love belongs here, and your brother, most of all, deserves better. You both do." She then gazed up at me with an expression that made the breath stumble over my beating heart as I exhaled. I'd never been looked at that way before, and I didn't even have words to describe it. I just felt down deep in my marrow how utterly and truly loved I was by this woman, and I shivered as if someone suddenly pulled a woolly sweater out of the dryer and slipped it over me. Shay's rosy mouth fell open as she gasped, and I knew she was feeling the strange connection buzzing between us.
"Oh, Alex,"
she murmured. "Do you know what this is?" I asked, as a giddy grin suddenly took over my features, and I squeezed her narrow waist.
"I've heard of this,"
she said in an equally excited voice as she did a little happy dance on her heels.
"It is said Natan natives imprint on the ones their souls are attuned to. It's been described as the reckoning when one soul recognizes the other truly for the first time."
"We're soulmates?" I breathed in awe.
"This I have known since I found you in that rowboat to sleep with our Zoe in your arms. Only now you know it too,"
the Phoenix Woman said as her blazing green eyes poured into my own, and the connection between us devolved into a feedback loop of joy, excitement, passion, lust, and deep, deep love. It was an amazing feeling. "Well then, my soul apparently says hello," I whispered, and pressed my forehead to hers.
"Hi,"
she whispered back, and I finally reached my limit of not kissing her. So I rectified this immediately by closing the gap between our lips. We stood there in the stairwell sharing a series of chaste yet achingly intimate kisses that had arousal burning low and sweet between us. Even though the potential to take it someplace else was there, we both had no desire to stoke that cozy flame into a blaze. For now it was just perfect letting our souls dance together on some unseen current of energy as we traded kisses like sips of honeyed wine. Eventually, Rufus got tired of being squished between us and wriggled out of Shay's arms with an annoyed little brrrt noise. He hopped up on my shoulder and fluffed out his dusty feathers like he was an irritated wet hen, and his offended antics made Shay and I break apart with laughter.
"Sorry, Roo,"
Shay giggled as I snickered into the curve of her downy neck.
"We made a Rufus sandwich, husband. You should apologize."
"Sorry, Rufus," I replied diligently and giggled as well. I felt a little punch drunk, like I'd just guzzled a whole bottle of champagne. "We should go to bed. I'm going to pay for it if we stay up any longer. And you, my turtle dove, are getting chilly. You could get sick, you know. We're going to have to get you some slippers if you insist on walking around at night."
"See? There you go again,"
Shay said with a fond smile curling up the corners of her perfect lips.
"You are the one dead on your feet, and yet here you are taking care of everyone else."
"Are you going to take care of me then?" I asked, and then resumed walking up the rest of the stairs with my precious wife under the shelter of my arm.
"Always,"
she said. Then the two of us quietly pushed open the door, stripped down to where we were both naked once more, and joined our Zoe back under the warm blankets. The slumbering Catwoman didn't even wake up, but she still opened her arms for us as if her subconscious recognized our combined presence. Shay and I fell into her embrace once more, and the three of us fit together like puzzle pieces. We slept. Morning, like I feared, came way too early for my tastes, especially when I was ripped out of blissful unconsciousness by Rufus doing his best Fred Astaire impression on my chest.
"I don't remember actually asking for a wake-up call,"
I grumbled, as I squinted through the hazy dawn that peeked through the drapes. Good goddess, it was fucking early. And I tried to blink the gummy feeling out of my eyes as I looked around. Zoe was on her stomach with Shay draped over her bare back like blooming summer wisteria, and the heavy curtain of the Phoenix Woman's hair looked like it made a cozy red and gold streaked blanket for the two of them as they continued to sleep on like some tragically beautiful oil painting from the Renaissance. Damn, they were beautiful. This did not make getting up any easier, to say the least. And I flopped my head back down so I could groan quietly into my pillow. Rufus then went from tap dancing on my chest to moonwalking on my head, and he let out another annoyed brrrt noise before he nipped the top of my ear with his sharp beak. "Ow!" I hissed, and finally sat upright so the little menace had no choice but to balance on the bedside table.
"All right, you win. I'm up,"
the gold seeker whispered, and he fanned his tail feathers in a pleased sort of way. At least he was considerate to the others present who were still deeply under the Sandman's spell. I sat on the edge of the bed and let myself simply gaze at the two visions before me as my brain booted up. Shay and Zoe both sighed in tandem and then settled again like two sleeping doves cloistered together before the start of the day. All things considered, it was worth being awake to see such a beautiful sight. But the day was waiting for no one, so when the cobwebs weren't as thick in my head, I dragged myself to my feet, threw on a fresh set of pants and a burgundy tunic, and then tucked my sleeping beauties in more snugly before I left. My first stop was to the kitchen for a makeshift breakfast sandwich of sweet bread, cold creamy cheese, and dried meat that tasted a little like turkey jerky but wasn't half bad. I then washed it all down with some water I purified with one of the tithe stones sitting in a small clay bowl on the table. After that, I felt energized and ready to tackle that long honey-dew list I felt was growing by the minute. I'd never imagined myself as a property owner back on Earth, but I definitely loved throwing myself into my work fixing up the farm during those summers. Now that Ithaca was starting to feel like mine, I felt the need to really make her shine. So the next stop on my agenda was down where I left the fallen barn so I could roll up my sleeves and give this place the TLC it deserved. I knew we had stacks of lumber delivered from the woodcutters, and last I saw, they were bundled in large pallets in front of the workshed. Fixing the barn was as good a place to start as any, and the Porax really needed a place that could protect them at night. So with this decision made, I exited the courtyard, passed through the gate, and walked down to the barn with a slight spring in my step. When I got down the slope to the barnyard, I was a little stunned I wasn't the only one out here.
"Gifted morning to you, Mr. Alex,"
Mel said in the cheeriest voice. He was busy fitting planks of wood together in a way that looked like the skeleton of a floor. Bowden was on the other end laying down planks for the floorboards, but he stopped to wipe his brow under the brim of his hat and then waved at me. "Good morning, Mel," I said to the shorter raccoon brother. "How long have you all been out here? Seems as if you've all done a massive amount of work already and the day has barely started." I looked around at how the old barn had already been completely disassembled into scrap piles, and how even Arvid was already out here swinging a large axe so he could chop up some of the usable, non-rotted stuff for firewood.
"Not long, Mr. Alex, don't you fret," Mel graveled out. "We got some work done yesterday before the light went."
"Yesterday?" I gaped. "When?"
"Well, you were a tad distracted, sir,"
the raccoon man said, with a knowing grin as he scratched his belly through his shirt.
Oh, yeah,
I grinned sheepishly, and then looked around for something to change the subject. My eyes lighted on Arvid again as he split another hunk of wood, and I figured that was good enough.
Hey, thanks for leaving out breakfast, Arvi.
I waved at the big sloth man, and he lowered his tool for a moment so he could wave back.
"Welcome,"
he replied pleasantly, and then he continued to make short work of the log he was thunking that axe into. With a large crack, the beam split in two with a satisfying symmetry that made me want to give it a turn at some point.
"I'm just so impressed with everyone's work ethic that I feel a little bad for not being out here sooner,"
I followed the shorter raccoon brother as he walked over to retrieve a bundle of floorboard planks so he could help Bowden with the rest of the floor. "I forgot how efficient you both are, and I don't think I really expressed my gratitude to you and your brother. You've already done a lot to help get this place back on its feet, and it's nice to see how Ithaca is really starting to shape up."
"'Tis no trouble, Alex,"
Mel shrugged, as we both untied the bundle and laid out the planks that would fit together and wedge into the existing floor sills like Bowden was still doing on the other end.
"Our hope is to have the major projects out of the way before the cold settles in. After the barn is in good working order, we can start on the mill."
"Fantastic," I said, and watched how the raccoon man angled the board down on one end so it would fall next to its cousin beside it. "Do we have nails?"
"Ah, that's the beauty of Bowden's design,"
Mel said, and waved his brother over.
"We won't need 'em."
"What do you mean we won't need nails?" I asked dubiously, considering how the last structure fell apart and the fact I was pretty positive it had been a good barn when it was in its prime. It seemed a little counterintuitive that a better building could be held together without hardware.
"Let me show you," Bowden said and pulled a small square of folded paper out of his vest pocket.
Then he unfolded the paper several times until it was a big sheet of semi-transparent onion paper with some sort of diagram drawn on it.
"I'm afraid I took some liberties with the barn design when I prepared the lumber order for you."
"That's okay," I said, as I took one end of what I now recognized as some crude version of a blueprint, so we could both stretch it out between the two of us. "Show me what you were thinking." As you might be able to see from the plan, I have the woodcutters adhere to my specifications. Based on the specific way the cutters fashioned a few key parts, the whole building will be able to stand quite sturdily with just a few strategically placed wedges. My eyes roved over the hand-drawn cross-section of something that looked similar to a standard Dutch barn, and I could also see how much of the lumber was cut with tenons, or pegs, that more than likely fit into the pre-cut holes, or mortises of various other pieces. "I see," I said, and pictured fitting the wall posts down into the mortises like Lego pieces. That definitely dispelled the need for any sort of hardware or mortar, which was actually the most ideal use of our current time and resources. Because the last structure failed with almost disastrous consequences, I felt like this design was the safest, the raccoon architect went on, and with one lightly clawed finger, he pointed out the part of the diagram that looked like a classic anchor and beam design called an H-bent. The support for the entire building rests on a series of four frames just like this, where a strong anchor beam is fitted between two posts, and then secured at the corners with angled wooden braces. Having the center be the most stalwart point of the barn will allow it to withstand the weather for seasons to come. It looks bigger for some reason, but I'm looking at the floor sills, and it seems like it has the same amount of floor space as the old barn, I observed. Yep, same space. However, the design will allow us to section up the interior in order to maximize the barn's utility, Bowden said as he returned to the blueprint. Look here. The main center aisle is bigger, so we can even fit a carriage or two inside. It's also a good space to use as a workshop, I said as I eyed the dilapidated shed next to us. Well, that's what I was thinking as well, the taller raccoon brother agreed, with a grin on his masked face. This design also gives us two side aisles where we can keep the porax on one side and any other livestock like canterflies or what have you on the other. I know it's not as impressive as the stables Miss Shalia runs, but at least we can keep an eye on all our animals under one roof. I like that, I commented, and then cast my gaze up to the carriage house where Prosper was ostensibly still sleeping inside. From my vantage point, I could see how the small structure was looking a little drafty and worse for the wear as well, and the barn might be more comfortable for him once it was up. Also, this barn will have a much bigger loft spanning the entire length of the center aisle, and because the loft will be built right over the anchor beams and corner braces, there's no chance of it collapsing. Bowden finished triumphantly, and then folded the plans back up into their impossibly small packet so it could be returned to his vest pocket. You've really thought of everything. Good work, Bowden. I clapped the skilled architect on the shoulder. Good goddess, it's already a proper party out here, someone called out from behind us, and I turned to see Horace and Rylan walking toward us with their arms laden with a few clay jars and mugs, respectively.
We brought the last of the Coley tea,
Rylan piped, as he raised the mugs up for me to see. You guys, I groaned gratefully, as I took a mug and let Horace pour me a cup of the steamy, coffee-like brew. This is just what I needed. Thanks.
You're welcome,
Rylan said with a pleased smile, as I scrubbed my hand through his messy hair. How'd you sleep? I asked, and wondered if he remembered anything from the night before.
Great,
he said, and I figured everything about his sleepwalking adventure was wiped clean and couldn't help but chuckle. Legs good? I asked, just like a proper foster dad.
Yes,
Rylan rolled his eyes just like an annoyed preteen being pestered by his parental unit.
That means I can help today, right?
We'll see, I said, and laughed again at his repressed groan of irritation. Came a loud trumpeting noise that had me startling and almost spilling my hot Coley tea down my hand.
What the hell?
I said, as I looked up at the pale morning sky and saw a jet-black shadow streak across my line of sight.
Ugh, dark hell,
Horace cursed under his breath, as all of us watched the winged animal that looked like a cross between a raven and a praying mantis circle over us like a vulture before it landed in the center of the completed barn floorboards. In its creepy, pincered mouth, it held an official-looking missive with a black wax seal. What the fuck is that? I asked the falcon man to my left, given the fact he seemed to recognize the bizarre mantis raven clicking its claws at us.
It's my father's messenger, Agoric, he said with a scowl of disgust. I can only guess that whatever is in there isn't good.
Great. Just great. Cut one head off the asshole Hydra, and another one just takes its place.